My name is C.S. Song. Joining us now is Patrick Rail. He is a contributor to the book Slavery in New York, edited by Ira Berlin and Leslie Harris. His contribution takes the form of a chapter entitled The Long Death of Slavery, by which he means slavery in New York. He is an associate professor of history at Bowdoin College in the state of Maine, from where he joins us. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to start with the 1770s, during which certain ideas and principles were advanced by those who sought to gain freedom from British rule. Remind us of those lofty revolutionary principles and how they affected attitudes toward slaves.
Sure. The American revolutionaries absolutely predicated their argument for liberty using the metaphor of slavery and freedom. And some scholars, like Edmund Morgan, have suggested that it was the presence of slavery that actually permitted this notion of extreme liberty to emerge. We have to remember that the American revolutionaries were doing something that nobody had done before, and something that was wildly illegal. It was absolutely treasonous. There was no legal precedent for breaking free from a mother country. So they had to rely on some kind of transcendent principle that would not just serve as rationalization, they believed it, but they needed something that would buttress this revolution in the court of world opinion and in the eyes of themselves as moral human beings. That notion was universal human liberty, and that is the principle that is enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, and it's the one that we most commonly associate with the American Revolution.
Well, universal human, this sounds wonderful, and if applied to enslaved blacks, I mean, you'd think the logical presumption would it be obvious. It would follow logically that it would apply to enslaved people.
Yes, that is the catch. Throughout the American colonies, this paradox was not lost on the colonists or on their critics. I believe it was Samuel Johnson, the British satirist, who said, "Why is it that we hear the loudest yelps of liberty from the drivers of Negroes?" The paradox of fighting a revolutionary war for the principle of universal human freedom while holding slaves thundered throughout the colonies, and different places dealt with it differently. In the far southern colonies, like South Carolina, very little ideological momentum occurred to erode the institution of slavery. In the northern states, though, where slavery was an important component of the economy and society, but not as important as it was to the plantation economies further south, the principle of liberty got hold. And it actually had an impact on the way the northern states, after they became independent, dealt with this question of slavery. Some of the states, like Massachusetts, abolished slavery through judicial opinion. Some of the states, like Vermont, wrote slavery out of their state constitutions. In general, the principle was that the more closely tied to the economic, social, and cultural life of the state slavery was, the harder it fell, or it did not fall at all. And New York, which was really, along with New Jersey, the state in the North that was most reliant on slavery, most tied to the economy of slavery, in New York, slavery fell hard indeed.
Now, in the immediate post-Revolutionary War period, you write about certain concerns, certain rights taking precedence over racial concerns in fueling a kind of resistance, a very strong resistance to emancipation. What were the elites, what were white people so focused on preserving?
Sure. This is the great paradox of American liberty. I've spoken of this notion of universalism, of universal human liberty. What a wonderful idea. But there are other very central components of revolutionary thinking, of notions of American liberty. One of those is the concept of civic virtue. And this is the notion that in a self-governing republic, this radical experiment that the American revolutionaries devised, this place without a king, in such a society, it was critical that the people who exercised power, the people themselves, had to be good citizens. They had to be independent so that their votes and opinions were not swayed by others. They had to understand what society was about and what the common good really was. And it was believed that slaves and freed African Americans could not possess this civic liberty. The other critical principle that was in play here, that was part of the bedrock of American liberty, was the notion of property rights. One of the reasons why the American revolutionaries revolted was that they believed that their right to own and enjoy their property was being violated by the British Crown. Well, among those property rights was the right to own human beings as property. So that presented the revolutionary generation with a huge conundrum. If everyone is supposed to be free to enjoy their property, but you hold people as property, what happens then? And it was a debate that raged throughout the nation, but certainly in New York in the period around and after the Revolution.
And on the question of the alleged deficiencies of blacks to the extent or in the context of being able to be a good, productive citizen, to participate in civil society, there was a debate among those who thought that the deficiency arose from the enslavement, that actually slavery had caused blacks to be deficient in these ways, and others thought that the shortcomings were innate, were inherent somehow in the black constitution. Tell us more about the thinking on both sides.
Sure. What we're really talking about here is racial theory, which is a science of biology. And how did Euro-Americans understand the notion of blackness? Before the American Revolution, it's hard to pinpoint a very clear train of thinking about what blackness was, what caused it. The reality of slavery was sufficient to justify slavery. It was only with the Revolution and this questioning of slavery, maybe slavery is a moral crime, maybe it's something we should not do, that the question of what race is became tremendously important. And there's a shift over time. During the Revolution, the predominant mode of thinking we might call environmentalism. And this isn't environmentalism like conservationism. This is the notion that one's nature is determined by circumstance, by the environment, rather than some innate quality or characteristic. The American Revolution was a period in which environmentalist notions of human character and human nature and race tended to predominate, certainly not exclusively. What happens over time after the Revolution is that environmentalism gives way to something that I would call racial inherency. And this is the notion that there is something innate in black people. There is something inferior in their physical makeups. And in the 1830s and 1840s, this notion would emerge in the American School of Racial Science, which went so far as to argue that black people had been created at a separate creation before Adam and Eve were created. They were literally part of the animal kingdom.
We're speaking with Patrick Rail. He's a contributor to the book Slavery in New York. He is the author of Black Identity and Black Protest in the Antebellum North and co-editor of Pamphlets of Protest, an anthology of early African-American protest literature, 1790 to 1860. And we are talking about the phenomenon of slavery in New York for over two centuries. And Patrick Rail's contribution to this book focuses mainly on the very gradual piecemeal emancipation of slaves in New York that took place over a period of about 50 years after the American Revolution. You write interestingly that the wealthy elites of New York looked at the question of black rights differently from those who had less secure social positions. How did those viewpoints differ?
The elites had the luxury of being abolitionists. The John Jays of the world, very well-to-do, very well-connected, and economically they had options available to them that did not make them quite so dependent upon slaves. The people who tended to be most dependent upon slaves were they were known to be the Dutch farmers of Kings and Queens County. They were small slaveholders. They didn't grow a whole lot, but they were economically not very well off, and they were thought to depend more on their slaves than the elites. It's a strange thing in American history that those who have championed abolitionism tended to come from these higher ranks of society. And the general trend, and it clearly emerges from the Revolution to the Civil War, is that the farther down you tend to be on the socioeconomic scale, if you're white, the more competition you see yourself in with African Americans. And that was certainly the case with Irish immigrants, as you discussed with Leslie. And I think you see the roots of that in this period of the American Revolution.
That's interesting. So the wealthy elites had, what, less to fear from blacks becoming more socially and politically empowered?
That's exactly right. They did not have to worry about blacks out-competing them for resources. And they tended to have an approach to society that predisposed them to offer a kind of help, paternalistic, patronizing kind of help to the lower orders, and blacks were among them. So it was the elites in New York society who created charitable institutions, reform organizations, temperance societies, all this huge spate of reform effort, among which the uplifting of African Americans was just one component.
The American Colonization Society was formed in 1817. What was it dedicated to, and who belonged to it?
The American Colonization Society was founded by some of the nation's most important and powerful people: Bushrod Washington, the son of George Washington, Francis Scott Key was a member. The leading lights in American society, President Andrew Jackson, counted themselves among the champions of the American Colonization Society. The American Colonization Society had this idea. The idea was, look, slavery is a problem. Slavery is not a good thing for us to have in this country. But blacks aren't a good thing for us to have either, because they are a kind of degraded species of being, as they would have said. So why don't we do this? Why don't we have a reform effort to encourage private slaveholders to manumit their slaves, and then we will raise some money and try to outfit some ships and send these manumitted slaves, quote, back to Africa, even though they hadn't been born there, where they can settle in Sierra Leone or Liberia and begin basically a black version of the Great American Expansion Experiment. That was the notion.
And how far did they get, and what was black sentiment towards such an idea?
Well, it was the American Colonization Society was kind of Janus-faced. It posed itself in one way toward the slaveholders and a white society, and another way toward the blacks. Toward the blacks, it tended to say, this is going to be great. We'll send you off, and you can start your own colony. You won't have to worry about prejudice, which is inescapable here. And to whites, it said, these horrible blacks will get them out of your way, and you won't have to worry about them anymore. Some African-Americans took them up on their offer. Daniel Coker, John Brown Russworm. There were some important and prominent African-Americans who actually went. Over the span of the society's existence probably sent several thousand African Americans to Africa. But overwhelmingly, free blacks rejected it. They believed that the effort was insincere, and they believed that if they gave up, if they acceded to the society's logic, they would be giving up on America. They would be saying, we can never change this place. We will never be able to rid the country of prejudice, and we are not willing to accept that.
You write that African Americans in New York City created their own vision of racial uplift. And here we get to sort of African and African American agency, what they did in relation to the prejudice, the racism, the concerns, the class-based concerns of many of their potential competitors in white society. What was this racial uplift vision, and what did the African Americans who participated in these kinds of institutions urge blacks to act? How did they urge blacks to act?
African Americans, as they became free, as they had the liberty to organize themselves without constant white oversight, began to found a whole series of institutions, sometimes in partnerships with whites, like the African Free School, but oftentimes on their own, black churches like the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church. They founded literary societies. They founded the African Society for Mutual Relief, which was like a health insurance society. There's a whole range of institutions that black people created in New York to help them cope with this incredibly tenuous freedom that they had. These institutions tended to be run by people who would have been considered elite among African Americans. They were seen as prominent figures. They might not have had a whole lot of money, but that's how they were seen. And they had a kind of attitude that was very much a part of early 19th century American attitudes, which was that what you need to do once you're free is demonstrate that you can exercise your freedom. Because there have been so many arguments and so many debates up to this point about whether black people should be free or shouldn't be free. And all those debates have raged around the issue of black character. Are blacks elevatable, to use the language of the day? Are they capable of becoming good, productive citizens? And so a lot of the effort of these institutions was designed to demonstrate to the world that, yes, black people can be uplifted. The problem with this was, first it gave in to the terms of debate that said that somebody's citizenship should be dependent upon their character. But the other problem was that the game was rigged against free African Americans. White labor unions that were forming shut out blacks. Immigrants took their jobs away. Prejudice kept them down. Segregation in housing moved them away from the jobs. In every realm of life, African Americans were confronting harsh realities. So it didn't matter really how much character, how temperate they were, or how virtuous or punctual or whatever they were supposed to be. They were not going to be able to rise because the structural conditions in the economy did not permit it.
And you would think that whites who sincerely wondered whether African Americans could be productive members of society would pay some attention to at least giving newly freed blacks some material help so that they could gain a footing in society. Did that happen at all?
It happened very, very rarely. There might have been instances in these private emancipation agreements, such as those you spoke of with Leslie, where a favored master or a master might give a favored slave something, some kind of stake in a new life. But it was wholly up to the master, and it happened rarely. In general, what happened in New York was presaged what was going to happen in the U.S. South in 1865, when you had 4 million slaves freed into a competitive capitalist economy with no capital. It's just a recipe for impoverishment And that's exactly what happened in New York.
On the political side, one stereotype about blacks was that they were a source of political corruption. How did that thinking go?
The notion was that black votes were available to the highest bidder. In New York politics in this period was generally the Federalists, who were the probably, you in most ways, considered the more conservative party, and the Republicans, who were considered the more radical party. But the Federalists were thought to, and the Federalists were the ones who really championed abolition and emancipation. So they were commonly understood as being, that blacks would be allied to them. And in the same way, Irish immigrants and others were going to be allied, and workers were going to be allied to the Republicans. Each political party claimed that the other one bought votes from its constituent group. So the Federalists were thought to buy the votes of blacks, and the Republicans were thought to buy the votes of immigrants. And this was seen as a source of political corruption. The solution to this, somehow, in the 1821 State Constitutional Convention, got to be, well, disfranchise blacks, or make it hard for blacks to vote. And that's exactly what they did. They imposed a $250 property requirement in order for blacks to vote. And that was an incredibly large sum, and it disfranchised nearly all of the black population. So what we have here is this, the emergence of a polity, the emergence of public culture being defined as white, that at the very time that the electorate is expanding and opening up to everybody, when the property requirement is falling for everybody, it's being imposed for blacks. And this is a trend that is happening in other northern states as well. It would happen in Pennsylvania in 1835. All of these northern states, we typically call this the Age of the Common Man or the Age of Jackson, because it's supposed to be the great expansion of American democracy. What's less well remembered is that it happens by sacrificing black participation in the polity.
Fascinating stuff. Patrick Rail, Associate Professor of History at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, contributor to the book Slavery in New York. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Sung. Please visit our companion website, againstthegrain.org, which has instructions for ordering CD copies of programs, links to related resources, and MP3 audio from recent shows, as well as ways of reaching C.S. and Sasha. And to make a comment or suggestion, drop us an email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org or call us at 510-848-6767, extension 209. Our theme music is by Damal Sound System. Check them out at damalsf.com.